So like all
the
those
poor genetically fucked up pugs.
The poor genetically fucked up pugs, exactly.
Song elicits the weirdest dance for me, and Elsa, you can't see it, and neither can the audience, but you should be glad you can't, honestly.
You know, fun fact, same. I do a little shoulder popping thing that I don't think like is natural to any form of life on earth, but it's like as soon as that song comes on, I'm just like, oh yeah, shoulder pop away.
It's so true. All right, Elsa, what are we talking about today?
Well, Quincy, today we are talking about, once again, my favorite subject, evolution.
Oh my God, here we go.
Oh, this is episode 2 of evolution. If you'll recall, gentle viewers, the last time we talked about this fantastic topic, I gave you some historical context for like what the study of biology looked like before the theory of evolution came out, kind of the timeline for these things, a few important names. Within the theory, we learned that Darwin was not actually the first to come up with this theory, and that, well, he was the first to come up with it as a scientific theory with evidence and, like, presented, so, like, yeah, credit totally goes to Darwin. But, like, these ideas were kind of being kicked around, but they were being mostly suppressed, and, like, we mentioned that, like, Darwin's grandfather was a poet, and he'd write about, like, a natural ancestor, but as a poet, so that no one could get mad and stuff.
Yeah, I feel like Darwin's grandfather is the real hero of the story, because, like, what a badass thing to do.
Right? He was just like, I want to be a scientist, but no one will take me seriously. So I'll become the village madman and just write poetry about ridiculous concepts. And because I'm a poet, no one can touch me. I think that's hilarious.
Yes, it's so funny. And in our relationship, I would be Darwin's grandfather and you would be Darwin.
That's totally true.
Like, I've got the ideas, but I haven't put it together yet.
You're just prancing around. You're like, ah, yes. Just like this creative madman.
Yeah, exactly. And you'd be like, all right, settle down, Grandpa. I've got this.
Yeah. I'd be like, Grandpa, we need some evidence. And you'd be like, no, we just have to make it rhyme. So today we are not actually improvising and reenacting Darwin and his grandfather's relationship, much to your dismay, I'm sure.
Although if you want it, we could make it happen.
Bonus episode. Here we come. But we're talking about, we're going to focus really on the evidence for evolution. So what this episode is mostly going to be about is I'm going to bring up a mini topic, kind of like a sectional, like one thing that we say like, oh, we see this in various organisms and we take it as evidence for evolution. And I'm going to give examples. So last time we were very theoretical, it was like very like big picture, dates, people, thoughts, you know. Now it's going to be like some concrete examples to really help us understand all of these words I've been throwing out.
All right, hit me with them.
All right. So the first little sample is it's going to debate kind of like selective breeding and artificial selection. So if you recall, Quincy, last time we talked about the mechanism of evolution is natural selection. Could you give me just like what you remember, like a sentence definition?
Yeah, okay, sure. So populations are naturally variable because our genetics are different. And so those genetics mm-hmm. show differently. And what happens are external forces in the environment will typically favor some over others, and that will allow some genetics to live longer and produce more, you know, more efficiently than others. And eventually, over generations, the genetics that we see will change and shift towards more prosperous, I guess, genetics.
Oh my God, 10 out of 10. You got the three main concepts there down pat. One, that our genetics are random and there's a random variety within the population. Two, that this operates on a population level. And three, that the environment will select for the most beneficial traits. Like, love it.
Yeah, I remember my second year biology.
Wait, really? You know about biology?
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to talk about a specific example of selective breeding or artificial selection. Now, humans do this a lot. Humans kind of like choose for breeds and traits and kind of like speed up the process where we make animals mates. And you can see this a lot in dog breeds. It's just kind of a note in pigeons as well, like carrier pigeons and all that jazz. Also, we do it with plants. So like a lot of things like broccoli, Brussels sprouts, kale, all of those kind of like deep green leafy vegetables all originally came from mustard seed. And through a combination of natural selection and artificial breeding, we've like created these different vegetables from this like one ancestral plant and stuff. So we do this a lot. Oh my God,
I didn't realize
that. I know, right?
That's
like kale, crazy. Broccoli, and Brussels sprouts. All the children of mustard seed.
Holy shit. That's kind of like mind-blowing.
Oh man, that's my first fact. You're in for a
this
treat.
This is going to be a wild ride.
Yeah. If that amazed you, wait till what comes next. That's an example of mustard seed to kale, broccoli and stuff of us doing it like well. If you look at like dog breeds now, specifically like pugs and things that have really smushed in faces that kind of limit their breathing and stuff like that, you can see that when humans select for traits, it's not necessarily the trait that benefits the organism, right? So like all those
poor
dogs,
genetically fucked up pugs.
The poor genetically fucked up pugs, exactly. Like those French bulldogs, all those dogs whose snout are not quite long enough and they have these like chronic breathing ailments, or like all the dogs with like super short legs with dwarfism that were like, short legs are adorable, you know, let's breed that everywhere. And it's like, well, I mean, some of these dogs are pretty big. They need some bigger legs. And they're like, no, it's pretty cute.
Yeah, humans on the whole are kind of assholes. Every episode we establish this, but I gotta say it again.
We do kind of. Yeah, but that's just an example that like, that's not the environment. That's like humans being like, we want this trait. And then it turns out that those traits that weren't selected for by the environment aren't the best to live with. You know? And it's like, yeah.
We should have known that.
Yeah, we should. Like somewhere along the line, like it's not that we did it once and we haven't learned. It's that like, there are like French bulldogs, pugs, bulldog. You know what I mean? Like, there's so many breeds that we've done.
And there's pure breed lines of them. Like, we only mate them with each other so that they will continue to be the most of it.
Every single dog breeder. A year ago, I was looking into getting a dog when I had money. Now I'm unemployed and I don't have a dog, which is probably good. But every single dog breeder who breeds like a pure breed talks about the risk of genetic fucked up traits, like recessive traits that exist in purebreds. And it's like, just let them interbreed. Like, anyways, that's not even the example for artificial selection. The example for artificial selection is a study about the domestication of foxes. So pretty similar to dogs, but not quite. Now, this study was conducted by Dmitry, forgive me for this pronunciation, Belveev, I think? It's Russian. So this was conducted in 1960. So what basically happens is this Russian scientist, Dmitry,
Sorry, you and Dmitry are old pals, aren't you?
Yeah, Dmitry and I are buds.
You've never been able to say his last name, but it didn't matter to him.
So Dmitry went to a fox farm, and his goal was to help them create a fur farm. His goal was to help them create more docile foxes so that they'd be easier to kind of harvest. So
which is so funny.
Yeah, like the ethics of this study are kind of like, well, okay. But we're going to talk about it anyways because the genetics are interesting.
That's very true. But oh my gosh, I love like... some of the best science that's ever been done. The research was done for such negative purposes.
I know. You look at past studies sometimes and you're like, but
questionable.
Yeah.
However, so useful.
It was always like monetary. Mm-hmm. And we actually had a real problem, especially after the Stephen Harper era, when he passed a whole bunch of laws, like kind of limiting scientific research, where like it really limited research that didn't have a goal in mind or like a monetary.
Right.
And that's like, if you're only looking for things that will make you money, you won't find the stuff that actually is existing around you, you know? It's blinders. Anyways, he was like, we need fur from foxes, so let's get some more docile specimens. So what he did is he took the foxes and he put them in three categories. So category one was if when you approached the fox, there was some kind of positive response. So they looked up at you, maybe a little tail wag, maybe they took a step towards you, you know, like curious or investigative. Category two foxes was there was no positive response, but they were not overtly hostile. So maybe they back up a little nervously, maybe their tail goes between their legs, but they're not like trying to bite you.
I love that category, not overtly hostile. Like, yeah, like right? A fox is like really considering how to behave to you.
Yeah, he's like, I haven't decided how I'm going to react yet. Yeah. But like, still up in the air, depends on what you do. And then category three foxes, they either fled, like they sprinted away, or they would like try to bite your hand or growl. There was a negative response to a human approach.
That would be my favorite job, I think, just deciding which category these foxes belong to.
Just going up and being like, foxy boy, you're...
You seem nice. You're a nice foxo.
You are. Yeah, you are accepted. So the unfortunate part of that job is that he took class one and he bred from them and he kept them, but he kind of sent class two and three out to the fur farm, like right away. He was like, use these guys. He took class one foxes and he only bred from them. And after six generations, so this is important, evolution, as we mentioned earlier, happens at a population level over the course of generations. So an organism that has already been born is not going to like, quote unquote, like evolve. It's their generations, right? They'll pass down traits. So after six generations, he developed a new category of foxes. And he called this is the most hilarious name ever. It's called Domestic Elite Class One.
Fancy.
Yeah, Dimitri, my boy, you conducted a very good study and it will be very interesting in a second, but that is such a pompous name for foxes that like humans. Like, it's like Domestic Elite Class
One.
Well,
honestly, like, I feel like I want to be a part of it.
And just go hang out with foxes?
Yeah, like, where's my membership?
I am sympathetic to that. I think it would be so cool. So this Domestic Elite Class One, it was defined as a fox that was super happy to see you. So kind of like a puppy. You walk up to them and they're like, oh my God, it's you. And you're like, hey, fox. And they're like, I love you. Like that kind of response.
Right.
Yeah. So after six generations, this class emerged and he was able to categorize it. So like super friendly. After 10 generations, 18% of the population was this Domestic Elite class. And again, he's selecting which foxes get to breed and stuff like that. So this is an example of natural selection where the environment just naturally 18% of the population. This is the humans are creating the environment, are choosing who gets bred. So after 20 generations, 35% of the population was this Domestic Elite. Mm-hmm. And after 35 generations, 70 to 80% of them was Domestic Elite. So you can see that this trait of being adapted to humans, of being like comfortable around humans, of being really friendly is genetic.
Yeah, right? Well, like, done, Dimitri.
Yeah, so there is a genetic component here that is getting passed down, because when you select for the creatures who are like this is not just a question of socialization. There is some genetic component getting passed down here. But the plot twist, along with the quote unquote improved behavior, so along with the more like puppy-like behavior of like, oh, I love you, the Domestic Elite started demonstrating different physical traits.
Ooh.
So tell me, Quincy, tell me if this reminds you of another type of animal. So the foxes started getting spots, so they started having non-uniform fur. They started developing floppy ears, curved tails. So if you think of a fox tail, it's very, very straight. Their tails started to develop a curve in them.
Aww.
And they started to bark instead of scream.
So they turned to beagles?
They basically, right? They started becoming dogs. So yeah, so instead of they start to do this little bark thing, whereas if you YouTube what a fox sounds like what the actual sound they make, it's this kind of like scream sound. And the other cool thing that happened that was like super like what is that the female foxes started going into heat twice a year, which is typical for a dog but not typical for a fox.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, so on so many levels, right, the more socialized that these animals became, the more that these traits that are like dogs kept, like the more these traits are like floppy ears, spotted fur, you know, like they start becoming more and more like dogs.
Yeah,
and
that's crazy. So,
yeah, Dimitri was like, what the fuck happened? So he did a little investigating. Mm-hmm. And he discovered that the trait that he was selecting for was actually the adrenal glands. So this like level of tameness tameness basically meant that they had less active adrenal glands, that they were producing less adrenaline, right?
Okay, yeah, makes
which
sense.
Is super cool, because they, you know, if you're going to be calm, you're going to be less like fight or flight, you're gonna, it's you get smaller doses of adrenaline at once, right?
Yeah, so totally.
Yeah, so instead of the foxes being constantly like, either like I'm gonna bite you or I'm gonna run, they were like a little more chill.
Yeah, but adrenal glands control quite a bit.
That's the thing. Oh my god, my next word is literally pleiotropy, and pleiotropy means one gene affects several phenotypes. Right. So you're exactly right. So by selecting for this one like behavioral trait, he was actually selecting for a genetic trait that had effects on multiple phenotypes. And you want to just remind us what phenotype means?
So a phenotype is the physical appearance of the genetics.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So your genotype is what genes you have, your phenotype is what gets expressed. Yeah. So this just shows us that like selection for one trait, this whole idea of like a larger intelligence selecting for one trait, one specific trait to develop, doesn't really work, because genetics do not, you cannot isolate one genetic trait and be like, okay, this organism, I'm only going to affect this trait. Like, no, the organism works in conjunction with itself, right? Selecting for one trait led to an effect on several, because this gene for adrenal glands was pleiotropic. It affected several phenotypes. After this study came out, we kind of started to redefine our theory on the domestication of dogs. So you can see easily how this study would make us think about the domestication of dogs, right? You take a wild species of dog, a fox or a wolf or something like that, and as its adrenal glands start to get less and less active, they start developing these traits that look like what we think of as dogs today, right? So there are two main theories for the domestication of dog, and both of them will involve that kind of process of over as they get more used to us, the ones who are more used to us breed and this happens. So the first one is called the adoption hypothesis.
Ooh,
and that's the
adoption
idea.
Adoption hypothesis.
Well, that's the idea.
Some excitement into it. Ooh. Ah. I'll be here all day just to make you like, you know, extra comments.
You're being like the crowd.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone needs a hype man.
Oh my God, I love it. Yeah, so the adoption hypothesis, pause for effect.
Yay.
There we go. So much better. The adoption hypothesis is basically that way back when, before dogs were domesticated, humans would live in these like social groups like we do now, in the sense of like cities and stuff like that. But we'd have these villages. We'd dispose of our waste. This will make sense in a second. We'll dispose of our waste a little bit away from our village so that it doesn't get contaminated and stuff like that. So there'd be like our garbage dump. With food left over and stuff like that, a little bit ways away, our village or our social group, right? Our little huts and stuff. Humans noticed these creatures who started to approach, and they kind of like the ones who were naturally within the population a little more sociable to humans. So like class one foxes, as was the case in that study, humans kind of like took them in, adopted them, bred them, and then by breeding them, we eventually got dogs and we taught them and we eventually domesticated them. The second theory of domestication for dogs is very similar, and it's this self-domestication theory. And it's basically the theory that our waste or trash that was a little far away from the village attracted wolves or wild dogs. And then they kind of self-domesticated, in the sense that like the dogs that were a little calmer and a little like more social would like set up their main homestead around our kind of like trash,
right,
or stuff like that. And then the more wild dogs or wolves would kind of set up their homestead farther away. And so that just kind of natural split in the population, where like the one population of wild wolves would kind of split into like wilder section and more domestic section, and then they would breed and like living off the trash and living just closer and closer to human existence, basically. They would kind of breed themselves into a little bit more domestication, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Or they would kind of like...
I feel like both hypotheses sort of make sense. Like, it would make sense that that would be the initial stages, because humans can't really get very close to wolves then.
Yeah.
But then, of course, the humans took over once they were a little more domesticated and like really went to town on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So people think that maybe like both these things happened. Some of them happened in different environments, a little more and a little less, you know. But this, after this Fox study, they were really like, oh, that makes sense. This wild creature went from being very wild to less wild, and it looked more like the thing we think of as a dog. And they were like, all right, this makes sense.
Gotcha. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Okay. So that was our first example. Our next kind of little bit of evidence for evolution I'm going to talk about is this thing called restricted development. And you'll notice that a lot of these pieces for evidence for evolution, they are, some of them are phrased in this way that does kind of diminish this idea of an overarching intellectual being, so intelligent design. So, and I do not mean to offend anybody. I am in no way, shape, or form implying that because the theory of evolution is like very well proven and like has a lot of evidence for it, that that necessarily means that any gods don't exist. You know what I mean? Religion and evolution definitely can have like a friendly partnership. So what I really want to do is I kind of want to explain these methods of development in a way where you can understand the kind of nuance and why people say that this wasn't like preconceived plan, and this isn't like an intelligent design, this is a state that happens naturally in response to the environment. Like, I just want to explain the nuance about why there is evidence for selection for the environment and stuff like that.
Right.
I am not trying to diminish anyone's beliefs or anyone's belief systems, just giving you a little bit more information, because I think oftentimes these debates become so toxic and stuff like that because people feel like they're being attacked, and I in no way want to attack anybody. I just want to calmly explain some of the evidence so that you can like take it in and decide for yourself. And be like, well, not decide if it's true or not, because evidence is evidence, but you know what I mean. Like, take it in and be like, oh, okay, here's why people say this, but this is in no way targeted, or this is just biology.
Yeah, it's just it's kind of an explanation between the difference of a random error versus a precise plan kind of thing.
Exactly, exactly. So we're going to talk about restricted development. And restricted development reflects the idea that nature does not work with an overarching plan. So traits cannot plan ahead to decide what they will become. This is something that we see in various species when we look for it, and in humans specifically. So I'm going to talk about humans, and I'm going to give just one example of the human eye, because I'm going to use the human eye and a few different examples later for other things. And so it'll just like carry through.
You really like the human eye.
I do. It's because it's so bad. Just listen. Because how the eye works is light hits the retina, and the retina is a plate of sensitive cells behind the lens, right? So it's photosensitive cells. So light hits the retina behind the lens, and it goes through the optic nerve. So this signal goes through the optic nerve, through the cone rods, then the pigment epithelium, which doesn't matter, it's just a different part. And then it connects to the nerves to your brain, and it sends this like information through your neurons to be like, here's what you see. Right? So depending on what light hits you, at what angle hits your eye, it's going to be interpreted as like a different color, a different shape. And it's basically the light reflects back, hits the optic, hits the retina, goes through all of these different things, and then goes into your neurons. Here's the design flaw. All that quote unquote wiring, so like the optic nerve, the cone rods, the pigment epithelium, is in front of the neuron, which degrades the image. So just the fact that all of that biological shit is like half, like there's so much stuff in between the light hitting your eye and the neuron that the image gets degraded by being passed down. Cause it's like a game of telephone a little bit, right?
Yeah, totally.
I'm talking to you, you're gonna know what I say. But if we play a game of telephone with like five different people and I'm trying to pass you a message and there's five people between us, it's gonna be less accurate to what I said. Right.
Oh my God. What could our vision really be like if it was more efficient?
Oh, just wait. The other thing is you have a blind spot where light hits the optic nerve. I know when you look at stuff, it doesn't look like you have a blind spot, but that's because your brain fills in what it assumes is the rest of the image. So your brain kind of goes like, I don't want to look in the world with this giant black dot in front of my eyes. Like, but just the fact that your eyes are constantly moving, right? So even though if you think you're looking at one thing, your eye is actually like kind of vibrating. So you're seeing,
It's making up an image for you. But wait, so we can actually, I know a way to demonstrate this to our audience. So if you close your left eye and then put your finger out in front of like your left eye, put like your index finger out in front.
Okay.
So, yeah. So it's out in front of the eye that's closed.
Yeah.
Then take your right hand and put your finger next to the other one.
Okay.
And focus your right eye on the left finger.
Okay.
And then just slowly move the right finger across like your vision while still focusing on your left finger. And you'll see kind of in your peripheral that black hole appear.
Oh shit, you're right.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. Oh, that's so cool. Okay, gentle viewers, I hope you enjoyed that.
Yeah, I hope you were able to see it. And if not, like, look up a YouTube video on it and it'll show you how to properly do it with visuals. But like, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, give it a few tries. Mm-hmm. Oh, that is super cool. Yeah, okay. So the way our eye is designed, we actually have a blind spot and our brain just kind of fudges it. It just goes like, I think I know what it is. You know, when you don't really want to do the work on your homework, but you kind of want to kind of guesstimate what the answer is going to be.
Right. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, your brain basically does that. The other thing that like kind of shows that our eye is not in fact this like ultimate design is that we can actually see only a very limited spectrum of light. So for example, we see between 424 to 560 nanometers of light. So that's just the visible spectrum, right? That's basically purple to red. Are those?
Yeah, the colors.
The colors. We see colors.
Yeah.
Birds, so we see 424 to 560. Birds see 370 to 565. And insects see 340 to 540. So they have a much wider spectrum than we do. They see a lot more colors.
Right.
And the theory about why we only see the colors that we see is because we needed to be able to tell when fruits ripened so that we knew when to eat them.
Isn't there like a weird sea fish that was discovered that has like a crazy amount of color that it can see? I can't remember what it was called.
Oh, a peacock mantis.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah. That's like crazy amounts of colors that they can see. Supposedly, we don't know, but.
They can see they can see so much stuff that you can't even like comprehend the stuff they can see, right? Because there are so many colors that are reflected on different objects that we just don't know are there.
That's so cool. That's the thing too, isn't it? Like the color that we perceive as gray is actually potentially a color that we just can't see. Yeah.
There are so many things like that. Like there are so many objects and stuff like that where you're like, that's green. But if you look at the light spectrum it emits, it also emits this other like wavelength that's just outside of our vision. So like, it's also kind of another color, but you don't know.
Right. Gotcha.
But yeah, the human eye is not the most ideal eye. There are eyes, like so many eyes, very present in the like larger variation of species. I don't know. Biodiversity. How could I not think of the word biodiversity?
Sometimes like, science is hard.
Sometimes words are hard. So the human eye is one, it's designed in this kind of flawed way that gives us a flawed image. We have a blind spot and it doesn't even see that many colors. if you were to design an eye from scratch, I'd make it better.
That's very, very true. Yeah. And also the whole flipping the image thing. Like, what is that?
Yeah, right. Where it's like you actually see the image up upside down and your brain is just like, I'll fix this for you. What? Like our brain is doing so much work for our stupid eyes.
I think it would be so funny to be like the first, you know, whatever, somewhere in evolution, someone who didn't have the brain saying, I'll fix this. Just being totally confused.
I'm walking on the ceiling.
Well, so there must be people though that have like brain damage that lose that function.
Do you think? I don't know. I must admit, I do not understand the neurobiology of that flipping. Like I know it happens, but I don't understand the process. I don't know.
I'm going to look into that because that's actually very fascinating to me.
Okay. Yeah. Do a little, some Googling.
We'll give an update in the next evolution episode.
Yeah. We'll be like, by the way. Yeah, but our next evidence for evolution is called acceptance.
Ah.
Yeah. Excellent. So this is the concept that this is a trait that evolves for one purpose and then subsequently evolves for a primary other purpose. So your primary purpose of this one trait is A, and then eventually A stops being useful, and so that trait
developed a different primary purpose. A big example of that is feathers. So now almost all creatures that have feathers, birds basically, they use their feathers for flight, right? Mm-hmm. But we know now that feathers started with dinosaurs, like the T-Rex. And obviously the T-Rex could not fly.
I'm trying to picture it though with his little arms flapping.
Little tiny arms. You know that moment in Meet the Robinsons where he's like, I have a big head. It's like that.
It's totally like that.
So they theorized that the primary function for feathers in dinosaurs like the T-Rex was insulation. Feathers are actually very, very good at insulating. They keep the heat in. Over time, dinosaurs developed, a lot of them got killed off, different species developed, et cetera, and feathers are now used primarily for flight, right? So that is an example of a trait that used to have a different primary purpose than it does now.
Well, and sometimes it still has the same purpose, but it's like dual. It's like flying and insulation.
Yeah, exactly. So when I say primary purpose, I don't in any way, shape, or form mean it's the only purpose.
Right, it's just
like the most important purpose, right? Mm-hmm. So this is actually a super cool example. It's a little hard to picture visually, so I'm going to try to explain it as best as I can, but this is super cool. So the basic premise is we have three little bones in our ears called the stapes, malleus, and incus. And how sound works, real quick, vibrations hit your eardrum. The eardrum vibrates, that sound travels through this little like hollow part of your ear, the ear canal. And then the vibrations kind of hit these three little bones, the stapes, malleus, incus. The three little bones vibrate, that sends the vibration to your cochlea, which is this little piece in your ear that's full of liquid. So the vibrations go from air vibrations or like physical vibrations in these bones vibrating to vibrations in the liquid. So you have this little circular thing that looks like a shell. And it has liquid in it. And so the stapes, malleus, and incus vibrate, the liquid in the cochlea vibrate, and that sends a signal to your neurons, and that tells you that you're hearing something.
That might be the best explanation of hearing I have ever heard.
Really? Well, my mom's an audiologist, so.
Yeah. That definitely helps.
Oh, yeah. Like, all of my first projects were always, like, about, like, in, like, elementary school, were about the ear and sound, because mom would talk about it, and I would be fascinated. I'd be like, whoa. So these three little bones, stapes, malleus, and incus, were originally jaw bones.
Whoa.
I know. Okay, so we know that they were originally jaw bones. The evidence for this is fossil records and currently living species that show these bones that we've seen in past fossil records. So we found fossil records of the like change in the structure of these bones, which I will get into in a second. And we also see species that are currently alive at different stages of this development. So we can find examples from the past and in the present.
My brain does not want to comprehend that. I'm like, how did they go from the jaw?
Right? So what you first have to picture is a fish.
Okay, picturing.
And the first fish way back when did not have jaws. They just had an opening for their mouths. And you can find species of fish like this in the deep, deep ocean where they don't have a jaw that opens and closes. They just have an opening and you have to kind of like fly around and just get food in that opening, right?
Okay, yep.
So the first fish did not have a jawbone. But to eat bigger food, and therefore grow bigger, you need to widen your mouth and clamp down and chew it, right? So to eat bigger food, you have to be able to mash that food into smaller bits, and you have to be able to open your mouth wide enough to get the food in your mouth.
Right, because there's bones and there's exoskeletons and there's all this stuff that you choke on otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. And once again, this isn't like a conscious thing where the fish is like, I want to eat bigger food. But in the environment, if all the fish are eating the same type of food, then there's like an opening in the ecosystem for something that could eat the next stage up of bigger food, right?
Yeah, so like the weird genetically mutated one who has a couple bones in his mouth that allow him to open it. It got preferred, and then another weird mutation came along where the thing was able to chomp, and it got preferred.
Yeah, exactly. There was an open niche in the environment that selected for these freaks.
The freaks. Freaks and geeks.
What you now need to know is fish have these things called brachial arches, And basically they pump water into fish. These are kind of at the gills, right? They have these brachial arches at the gills that pump water into fish. It's how they breathe. So if you picture gills on a fish, they're kind of like in a row and those kind of like curved, like can you see, like if you just were to draw gills on paper, those three lines?
Okay, yes, I'm visualizing.
Okay, because what slowly starts to happen is those brachial arches start to get more flexible. So those gills that are kind of curved, like the front ones, start to get more flexible until it could kind of clamp down.
Right.
Can you see how that would kind of like, you go from like this little arch to like, it, imagine the arch just gets more and more defined.
Yeah, definitely.
Like as I'm explaining this to you, I'm making like the puppet eating motion where I'm like slowly putting my hand from this like straight position to like a puppet face.
It's a good thing we're on the same page.
So the first one, picture the first, if we have three gills, the first one starts to clamp down and becomes more of like a jaw type thing. So the support bone behind that, let's say that kind of like second gill there, the support bone called the hyomandibular, was needed when this brachial arch like was weak. So when it first starts to be able to clamp, it's kind of like a weak clamp, right? Because it's doing a new thing. And so it needed a support bone. The jaw was not strong enough to really clamp down. So the support bone is kind of there. Eventually what starts to happen, way, way, way back when, these kind of fish species will become reptiles and they'll become mammals. And so this jawbone is going to work in two different ways for reptiles and mammals. So if you think about reptiles, think about like snakes and like that kind of thing. Think about how big they can open their jaws.
Really, really big.
Really, really big. But snakes tend to swallow things whole, right? They don't tend to like clamp down and chew so they have a lot of flexibility, a lot of movement, a lot of range, but they don't have a lot of strength. Whereas mammals, you think about like a dog, a cat, they can only open their jaw so wide. We can only open our jaw so wide.
Right.
But our jaw is freaking strong. Yeah, like we can chomp carrots, we can bite these hard, hard things that like, if you picture a snake would not be able to chomp a carrot.
This is kind of a fact that goes along with that, like our pressure and our amount we're able to chew. I work with a dentist, so I hear a lot of dental facts, but so normal chewing, it takes place around 68 pounds per square inch, so 68 PSI.
Okay.
And then deliberately clenching, that gets our pressure, like our PSI, to 150. And then unconscious grinding at night can be up to 900 PSI.
Oh like, my God.
It is crazy the amount of force we can put on our teeth.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's just like the jaw just being crazy strong.
Oh, that's so cool.
I know. It's really cool.
Oh man.
But also really bad. If you're grinding your teeth at night, you need to go to your dentist and get it sorted.
Oh, I love this suit. Anyways, okay, so back to the reptiles versus mammals. So so we have this flexible brachial arch and the support hyomandibular bone. So what starts to happen is in reptiles, this flexibility is important, strength not so important. So the hyomandibular bone starts to shrink, and what happens to them is all their little bones, they have a lot of small bones in their jaw that are fragile, but they can open wider. So the reptiles don't have a stapes, incus, and malus, right? They don't have that same kind of hearing. They don't have an external ear and that kind of vibrational thing. But because all those bones stayed in the jaw area and went to work making it more flexible. So they, like those types of fish that became reptiles, selected for more articulation rather than strength. Environment.
They went that totally makes sense.
So they don't have those ear bones because they have articulating jaws.
Yeah.
Mammals, though, we wanted that strong. We wanted, again, when I say want, this is not a conscious want, just a way to explain.
It's just, it's kind of how we talk about evolution. And it's totally what confuses people when they're first learning about it, because it's the easiest way to say it. But we don't mean they wanted it, so they did it. It's just like the environment selected it.
Yeah, there was a niche that this trait fit into well. And so as it developed this way, it was successful. And so it propagated itself. Yeah, but exactly. The easiest way to kind of visualize these concepts is to say words like want or need or stuff like that. And at this point in the podcast, gentle viewers, we trust you to understand that.
Yeah. So we're going to continue to say want with the intention and the knowledge that you know what we're talking about.
Yes, exactly. So reptiles go evolve very articulate. Mammals, our jaws are, you can feel your jaw and you can kind of see this, our bottom jaw is one bone, right? You think of a skull, that's one bone, but it's a thick bone.
Sure is.
Yeah, so with these creatures, the brachial arch that could kind of clamp down and was flexible starts to get stronger and thicker, but it needs that kind of space. So the hyomandibular support bone starts to get in the way. So classic organism that's prioritizing something, the hyomandibular bone starts to shrink, right? Every generation that doesn't use it expends less energy, like developing that, less resources within your body developing that, and so it starts to get smaller and smaller, and just over time, genetically it's smaller, and it starts to move as the jaw becomes stronger and stronger and takes up more space. It moves a little bit higher up.
Yeah, it gets pushed aside.
It gets pushed aside, basically. So yeah, so then that the hyomandibular bones start to shrink, and it will go on to become one of the bones. And so that's the kind of idea, is that I showed you that with the hyomandibular bone, but the quadrate and articular bones are two bones that you can see in snakes. You can specifically see in their jaw, there's a quadrate and articular bone. Those two bones went on to become the malus and the incus. And it's the same kind of concept. I just want to get too into where the bones are positioned, and because that visual kind of gets lost verbally. But basically, these three bones that used to be part of the gills and the support bones for the gills shrink as our jaw gets stronger and as the one bone gets thicker, and they kind of move up and they become those three little bones in our ear. So we went from a jawbone to hearing.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
That's wild. Oh man, it's so cool. Oh.
And yeah, just because it was we don't need you anymore. I don't know what to do with you.
Yeah, right? So it wasn't immediately, I don't need you, I'm going to make you into an ear. It was I don't need you, so you're going to get smaller, but I'm
just going to chill out.
Yeah, but in my genes, I still have this genetic code that tells me to make you. I'm just not going to spend a lot of energy doing it. So you're going to be smaller until it just slowly develops this other function.
Yeah, crazy.
Wild!
Yeah.
Oh, so wild.
And all of a sudden it's oh my God, you did have a purpose all along.
I developed a purpose for you.
It's cool a true love story.
Yeah, it is a true love story. So the next piece of evidence is vestigial structures. So this is the remnants of structures that were fully functioning in ancestors, but are now greatly reduced owing to a change in niche utilization. So again, the niche is the little pocket of environment where you specialize and you do stuff. So really, really quick, some things that were used that don't get used anymore, we give them as few resources as possible. So that's an example of our appendix. Originally, it stored bacteria, which break down vegetation. You can still see appendixes in rabbits. So rabbits eat a lot of grass. Grass is really hard to break down. The appendix helps that. It stores bacteria that will break that down. So we don't need it anymore, which means ours is very, 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 very small now. And people could say well, why is it even still there if we don't need it anymore? And
it's not our choice.
But also, that's the whole thing about vestigial structures, why don't you always just stop expressing them? So the appendix is not needed. So it became as small as it safely could to take up the least amount of resources, but not go so small it kills you. Because your appendix is this piece of your intestine at the end of the intestine. So it's gotten as small as it possibly could while not killing you. So if your appendix gets too small, your intestines get blocked up. And then oftentimes people who get appendicitis or their appendix burst or stuff like that, it's because their appendix was naturally smaller. So the appendix is not secretly still useful because we still have it or anything like that. It's a vestigial structure, but it's still there because our body making it any smaller would kill us.
Yeah. And it's tried to many times. There are many people who have had appendicitis.
Yeah, exactly. So we see in and not everyone was a tiny, not everyone who got appendicitis has a tiny appendix, obviously, but we see this variation of some people have more problems with their appendix, and sometimes it's because their appendix is too small and it winds up being a problem,
Yeah.
So Yeah. So again, traits are not this conscious thing. It's just like if your appendix got too small and killed you, you didn't pass on small appendixes to your children. Another quick thing is like cave salamanders. So cave salamanders essentially have no eyes. Those are those things where they have like eye sockets, but skin grows over them. And you're like, okay, why do they still have these eye sockets if they don't have eyes anymore? And that's that, like, so this, obviously there was a species of salamander that had eyes at one point, but if you're in a cave where there's no light and you can't see and your eyes are not useful to see, having eyes is actually a, like, actually physically possessing eyes that can't see very much in your environment is a risk factor, because it's basically an open wound into your body, right?
Yeah, eyes that's are not good.
That's not good. Think about children and how, like, dirty children are and how often they get pink eye. Like, eyes are just open and vulnerable places that can get infected. So if you're not using your eyes, it does not make sense to have them open for them to see, like, the rare thing or something like that. So these cave salamanders that have eye sockets but no eyes because skin grows over them, it's like, well, why, how did this happen? Well, at some point they use their eyes to see, and now they're in an environment where an eye is more of a risk than a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. So that is vestigial structures. It's a pretty simple concept. We have things that we don't use as much anymore, but they're still there because our body can't get rid of them. So the next thing we're going to talk about is atavism. Don't know how to say that. You put your own little spin on it. So this is an ancestral trait that gets triggered or turned on by quote unquote accident. So these are things that are in our genetic code that usually do not get expressed because the trigger to express them doesn't usually become activated. So the right. genes are still there, but they're unexpressed because the environment does not really ask it to be. But every now and then, by accident, they get turned on. So this is like tails in humans. You know, there's those like stories where like, oh, no, a human is born with a tail. Yeah, this is true. We're going to talk about this in the next example of embryology, but like during some point in your embryonic development, you can see the tail appears.
Yeah, we're like little tadpoles swimming around.
Yeah, exactly. And then later a different gene turns on and says, okay, don't like unbuild this tail, like use those resources for something else. We don't need the tail anymore. And you kind of like grow big enough that the tail no longer exists as a tail, right? That gene gets turned off.
But we've got a bone that looks like a tail.
We got a bone that looks like tail. Yeah. So every now and then there's a mistake and the gene doesn't get turned off and a human is born with a little tail.
Ugh. Sorry, that's so freaky.
It's not. It's just a little tail.
Nah, it's weird, man.
Okay. If any of our 5 listeners have tails, don't feel weird. It's perfectly fine.
I'm sure you can get it surgically fixed.
Stop shaming our tail listeners.
So sorry.
So our next little evidence for evolution example is embryology. So this is the study of embryos. So this is kind of a nuanced little example I'm going to give here, because basically the study of embryos gives us evidence for evolution in the sense that the development of human embryos reflects evolutionary development. So just to be clear, an embryo is not evolving. Evolving, if evolution happens over generations, it's a generational thing. It happens to populations. It doesn't happen to organisms. But the development of an embryo, when you look at every single stage, reflects evolutionary development in that we can see them pass through these different stages that we know our ancestors passed through, right? So and that means that those genes that express things like gills or tails or stuff like that, they are in our genetic makeup because at some point we must have used them. So when you see an embryo pass through a stage with gills, they start out with gills, and then you see them pass through a stage with a tail. And at some point they look like this kind of tadpole fishy thing. And then they look like this kind of reptile thing. And then when they're born, they often have that kind of like lanugo. That's what it's called. Lanugo, this peach fuzz fur, which you can see in like primates. So when a baby is like, after the tail goes away, you see this like peach like fur, which is like primates, which is a separate path. And even just the beginning, like embryos come from yolks. Essentially they come from eggs. Even though we're not egg layers anymore, we like carry our babies inside us instead of like giving birth to an egg that develops within that contained space. It's the our embryos, like our babies still start from those yolks. It's just we keep those yolks inside the female body instead of laying them out in an egg. Right.
I feel like we're like an old man going through his record collection and like pulling out some of the things that he used to like as a kid, but like, ah, nope, never mind. I'm searching and searching. And all of a sudden he's like, aha, the perfect one.
This is how we're going to do it. It's so true. Going through like the embryo stage of development is just like, ah, do we like gills? No. Turn that one off. What about a tail? Ah, no, turn that off. Don't need that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so just embryology, it reflects this evolutionary process where, like, you can see all the genes that used to be important get expressed and then turned off as the organism develops and goes, like, you don't need that, don't use that. All these vestigial structures that we're, like, we're not going to express these, we don't need them. So the other example of evolutionary evidence is biogeography. So this is just the study of the distribution of species and ecosystems across geographical space and geographical time. So this is like, you look at what animals live where in the present, and you look at what animals lived where in the past by looking at fossil records and stuff. So basically this shows you like a lot of different like speciation. And if you take into account the shift of tectonic plates, you can see where like this one species that looked like a llama traveled down, like you can follow fossil records. And if you take into account the like shift of tectonic plates, you can see where these different species crossed over different continents. So what this winds up resulting in is that you see like across different continents, you see these creatures that are almost identical, like penguins and ox are on opposite poles, but they fill the same geographical niche. And so they look ridiculously similar. Like if you just quickly Google penguin versus auk. So this is just the idea that like the same environment selects for the same kind of trait over geographical space and time. So it's like, it's evidence that the environment selects what we want and that we can see different stages of development if we look at fossils and we look at where they went and how they went. So our second to last example here is the biochemical and biomolecular evidence for evolution. Now, just to be clear, Darwin did not know any of this. As we mentioned before, Darwin didn't really understand genetics, and poor Gregor Mendel, even though he came out with a brilliant, brilliant research about how genes are passed on and this whole concept of genetics, Darwin could not understand it because it was written very mathematical. So when the theory of evolution came out, we didn't know all this stuff. But since, all that we have discovered about biochemical and biomolecular evidence supports the theory of evolution. So Darwin did not know any of this, and yet everything we've discovered about our own biochemistry and about the biochemistry of animals and plants supports the theory of evolution. So that is like huge.
It's crazy. It's like the biggest gamble of all time, and it paid off huge.
Yeah, right? It's like, I don't know this huge chunk of information that's really essential to my theory, but turns out everything we find out supports my theory. So like this really shows that Darwin operated from data. He took data, he made observations, and he like listened to the data.
Yeah. His observations of just more simple things were just still rang true.
Yeah, exactly. So this, I'm just going to give one biochemical example because it just stuff gets super complicated and super like very specific pathways of this one gene. But there's this cool type of genes called Hox genes. And these are an almost universal set of genes. So we see these genes in mammals, in insects, in birds, like these are almost universal set of genes that are instructional. So these are genes that we find, and they are identical across species. And basically what this gene says is it's instruction genes that says, turn this gene on, or make an eye here, or make a leg here. So they're these basic instructions. So it'll be like in a mouse, if you have a Hox gene that says make a leg here, and then like you go and it'll tell you like go over here to make a leg, and you go over there in that gene, and then the mouse will have a gene that will code for a mouse leg, and it'll make a mouse leg. In humans, we have that same gene that says make a leg, but it points you to the section of genes that tells you how to make a human leg, and then you make a human leg. But that basic instruction of like turn that on, turn that off is universal. It is the same coding. It's the same DNA. It's the same RNA. It is universal across most species, which is wild.
Yeah, it's really crazy.
Yeah, so it shows this concept that, like, even just the fact that all living life has basically the same building blocks. We all have DNA, we all have RNA, we all use amino acids to build things, right? So just the fact that, like, we all use the same type of building blocks, and the basic instructions for those building blocks are identical, really does point to the fact that we have a common ancestor that passed on this genetic code, right? Because it all comes from this basic same place. And actually, they did some studies with insects and stuff where if you move hawk genes around, you can tell it, like, you can take a hawk gene from a mouse that says build a leg, put it in a fly, and it will build a fly leg.
And you can whoa.
Because the coding for the type of leg is in the species, but the coding build a leg is universal. So they've taken, like, genes from mice, put them in flies, and, like, they've gotten, like,
that's so fucked up.
Yeah, I know. And they made it actually a little bit more fucked up, and they put it in different places. So then they'd get flies with, like, legs coming out of their heads and stuff.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But it's a universal instruction. You can take it from one animal, right, put it in another animal, and it'll work.
I mean, it's super cool, but, like, what the hell?
Yeah, that's why they did it on flies and stuff. Humans have an easy time doing experiments on insects.
That's true.
They're like, let's just give them extra legs coming out of their eyes. And you're like, oh, but you don't have, no, already
done.
We don't
need to.
So we have one last piece of evidence at the end where we're going to talk about the human eye. But first, I'm just going to tell you about this E. coli study that is super cool. And it sums up a lot of the concepts that we were kind of talking about. So this E. coli study was done by Richard Lansky.
Mm-hmm. Classic.
Classic Richard Lansky. So he connects this study on E. coli. So he takes E. coli and he puts them in a vial of nutrients where it has glucose and citrate in it, but E. coli can't process citrate, they process glucose. So he puts them in a vial of nutrients and he sees the population grows until it reaches maximum capacity for the container, and then it plateaus and then slowly diminishes as the food runs out, right? Makes sense. You put it in this contained environment, the population grows until the environment can no longer support anymore, population plateaus, and then when the food runs out, they slowly start to die off. So just picture that as a graph.
Yeah.
So then he took a small stock of the E. coli and he put them in 12 new environments. So he seeded 12 new environments from the original. And every day he did the same thing. And he took a strain of E. coli and made 12 new lines from that stock. And he did this for 20 years.
And so the reason he can do it every day is because bacteria, their generation time is very, very, very quick. So
yeah,
when he's separating them, he's separating a new generation.
Exactly. That's exactly right. E. coli just reproduces. And they actually perform asexual reproduction, which means, this actually makes the study a little more interesting, which means that the genetic diversity that we're going to learn about is only due to mutations. So asexual reproduction means that you make an exact genetic copy of yourself. You kind of, like, split into two and now there's two of you, but it's the same genetics. So sexual reproduction, as we discussed, mom and dad, their genetics combine, you get new genetics, you're the baby who is new genetics. You're not an identical copy of either your mom or your dad, right?
Yeah, it's a lot more clear cut to research and study because you don't have to worry about all the different ways your genetics can be influenced by other parties.
Exactly. The only source of randomness is mutations. So that's, like, you can go through, and in fact, he will go through, like, the ancestral line, right? And you can track mutations. So he did this for 20 years, which means approximately 7,000 flask changes and approximately 45,000 generations of E. coli. So this is, like, the changes we're going to see happens over the course of 45,000 generations. So that's, like, so much evolutionary time. It's 20 years human-wise, but, like, in terms of E. coli, that is thousands of generations. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So Lansky made sure to kept a sample from the old generation, as I said. So this is essentially like he made his own fossil record. So every generation, he keeps a little sample. That's the same as a fossil. That's the equivalent of a fossil record nowadays.
Right, because he was able to just basically freeze them because the bacteria didn't die in the cold because of whatever temperature it was, but it slowed their ability to reproduce. So you get to keep the same the same generation, the ancestor.
Yeah, exactly. It's like science fiction. You freeze dry someone and then you unthaw them later and you can be like,
exactly.
Exactly. So here are the that was his study. Very interesting study. Here are the results. So in all strains, every single strain, he noticed eventually the individual E. coli got larger. So the individual E. coli organisms grew, like their body mass was larger by the end. And so the theory here is that the resources in this contained environment were limited. Therefore, each individual E. coli had to get better at hogging their fair share of resources, right? If you're in a limited environment, you have to fight for enough food to survive. There's not going to be this like higher consciousness, like, oh, let's divide all the food. And like, no. So in every single strand of E. coli, the E. coli themselves got physically larger. But when looking at the fossil record, Lansky found that this was a result of 59 different mutations. So they all got larger, but the method through which they got larger was different. There were 59 distinct and different mutations that resulted eventually in larger body size. But it was not one pathway that was predestined that they could set. It was not at all like that. It was random mutations that eventually those random mutations like made bigger and were like better for the environment got selected for. So 59 different mutations. I thought that was so cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool because like you almost expect like, oh, it would happen the same way every time because it's the same environment.
Yeah.
But no, it is really just whatever mutation occurs first, which just shows how random it has to be.
Yeah, exactly. So this was like great evidence for just the randomness of mutations that like I made literally the exact same environment for everyone and they chose different pathways. And again, not really chose.
Yes.
And here's the super cool part. Okay, so in one flask, it showed that the population didn't plateau and decrease, but plateaued, did the whole thing, like population rises, population plateaus, and then it continued rising.
Yeah, crazy. What?
Wild. And he was like, how did this happen? And so what was happening when he looked at the genetics of this is that the primary nutrient in the flask was glucose. So what happened with all the other populations is they ate glucose, got bigger, they reached maximum capacity for the environment, they plateaued, there was no more glucose, they started to die. But in the flask, there was also citrate. Now, regular E. coli cannot break down citrate. But in this one flask, this strain developed a metabolic pathway that allowed them to break down citrate over the course of generations. Like this happened over the course of generations, right? Lansky actually tracked back through his fossil records to see. And it turns out that the first mutation started like way back a few generations ago, started as several mutations that weren't harmful, but also were not selected for. So it only appeared in like a very small percentage of the population. So when you look back over the past populations of his fossil records, it was only like a very few of them that had these random, not really beneficial, but not really harmful mutations. And that small population passed it down a little bit and there was genetic diversity until it got to the point where enough mutations had occurred that these E. coli could break down citrate. And so when the population plateaued off of glucose, because they could also eat glucose, so glucose was first, right? It was the primary pathway. So when that population plateaued, it presented an opportunity for that tiny little population of E. coli within the like contained population, for the tiny little like for the few E. coli that had the mutation that could break down citrate, they now had a chance to thrive, where they could get nutrients that no one else in their environment could. So then their population started to rise again, which is like so cool.
Yeah, it's probably the coolest study on evolution ever done.
Right? Oh, so cool. So he does this and everyone is like, wow. And it's just a great example that illustrates a lot of the concepts that we've talked about. I just friggin' love it. Oh man.
It's really, really, really cool. I'm totally with you on that one.
Right? Okay, so now we're going to go back to the human eye, and this is the last example we have for evidence of evolution, and it is the concept of homology. This is the presence of fundamental similarities of structures and genes in different species based on common ancestors. So This is basically like, if we look at other species alive today, we can see these different features and traits in various forms of development. Like we can see, like this creature has the fully formed trait, that creature has the half trait. And I'll give an example using the human eye. So rules of homology are, you look at the position relative to the neighboring structure to see like how it changes, how it evolves. The presence of intermediate stages in related taxa, which means living relatives, which means like this species of frog has this thing, but you can see other species of frog have like a less developed version of that. So like in order for to be like, this is an example of homology, you have to be able to find living creatures with like less developed versions.
Right.
You'll see these similarities in embryonic development, presence of intermediates in fossil records. Like I said, you see these different stages and these sort of rules of homology, these structures and stuff like that agree with other homologies. So they like are in accordance with other structures from other organisms.
Right. Well, it happens a lot, like in whales and bats and humans, we all have like the hand bones.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you can see that like some bones are slightly longer, some bones are slightly shorter, and it creates these different kind of like paws or hands or stuff like that. But you see that the basic structure looks very similar. The one example I'm going to bring for this is the human eye, because we do see examples of this is an example of like how the human eye was not intentionally designed. And we can prove it by saying like there are currently organisms with these like underdeveloped versions of our eye, basically. So the eye they proposed developed in four steps. And we can see, again, we see organisms with each of these steps. So the first step one is you develop a single flat plate of photosensitive cells. So that basically means you start to be able to tell the difference between light and dark. So a lot of like cave species or deep ocean species have these kind of very underdeveloped eyes where they can tell the difference between like a shadow and light. So they can tell when something's like swimming over them or something like that, right? They can tell that something's blocking out light, that light exists.
Yeah, function much more essential for them.
Yeah, right. Especially because if you live at the bottom of the lake, you know you're safe if like you're low enough in the lake that the light can't reach you. So all you really need to know is how much light can reach you, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
So step two then is you start to develop a cup eye. So it's the same flat, like it's photosensitive cells, but it's just like picture it just a little bit curved. So what this does is you can start to tell the direction of light. So where the light is coming from, right? If it's a little curved and it hits at an angle, you're like, oh, the light's coming from that way. So now you can tell the direction of an approaching object. And again, you can find this in like a lot of aquatic species, some cave species and stuff like some underdeveloped organisms. You see these types of eyes where all they really need to know is which direction a predator is approaching them. Step three is you get this pinhole eye. So if you picture before, it was like kind of curved, like kind of in a C shape. Now the photosensitive cells curve all the way into almost a complete circle. They curve into a circle with a little tiny opening at the top. So that's called a pinhole eye. And that can form basic fuzzy images. So you could like tell if you're walking towards a tree, but you can't see the leaves. And you can like tell that this big organism is approaching you, but maybe it's a dog, maybe it's a wolf, maybe, you know what I mean? Like you get these fuzzy images, but it's pretty useful. It's like a big step up. You get an actual image of what's happening.
That's so funny to me, if everything just approaching you was a blob, but different size blobs, which is very important.
Yeah, different size blobs, please, Quincy. And once again, there are organisms with this pinhole eye. You can find organisms with these pinhole eyes. They still exist. And then step four is the one that we have. And that's basically that this like protein lens forms over the hole in your eye. And then that protein lens can focus an image. So that's what we have now, is the lens over top can kind of focus the image. I mean, some people are better, like some people genetically have better eyesight than others, but like now not only can I tell that that's a tree, but I can see its individual leaves. And very, very importantly, I can read language, right? Like I can see well enough that these symbols mean something different.
Yeah, that's a huge step for us.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this is just kind of an example. We talked about the human eye before and how it's like deeply flawed design, but it's, this is kind of an example to show that we can find, since we can find organisms with each stage of eye alive now, this like supports the idea that the final product is not of irreducible complexity. So one of these arguments that like people say, I think like life is intelligently designed, is they say, how could anything, like this is, our bodies are so complex and it uses it that like you cannot simplify any of our processes, or like you can't simplify any of our biology because we're so complex that we were designed this way. And it just goes to show that like you can actually find examples of simplified biology.
Yeah, no, for sure. Oh my God, this is so much information to take in. But
I know.
We are so complex as like a species, and it is hard to imagine that we have, you know, homologous structures that we see in other species, but it almost makes it easier to understand our own biology when we see it in a more simplistic form.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's like you can see how this developed and what sort of environment it was responding to and what sort of like things this could lead to, and oh, it's just so cool. So that is the end. I know this was a pretty long episode, but it has pretty cool stuff there.
It was all very important.
And by no means is this the last episode on evolution. We have not even talked about the sexes. Such a treat. Such a treat. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh, because they're species that only have one universal sex. You can think of spoiler.
Yeah, you're really spoiling the next episode.
You're right. So this is just some examples for evidence of evolution and just the type of stuff you can look for. And there's so many examples that are so cool for so many organisms. Like, I've barely scratched the surface. But Quincy, do you want to kind of give me like, I know it's hard, but do you want to kind of give me like a brief summary of what are your takeaways? What are the things that you're like, this?
Okay, so my takeaway, which is super, super, like, generic, but it's kind of my favorite. it's my very favorite part of this.
Yeah,
if you are a freak, don't worry. Eventually, you will find your niche, and you will dominate.
Oh my God, that is the best takeaway. I love that you've turned it into this like motivation. Oh yes,
thank you.
That is the vibe I want for 2021. That is the
yes,
attitude.
It's the vibe we need.
It's the vibe we need. Oh my God. It is. Quincy, like a mic drop moment there. There's nothing more I could say. Gentle viewers, thank you for listening.
We love you, even though, I mean, we do love you because it's your boyfriend and my mom, so.
Yeah, so much genuine love. And I'm sorry, if you feel left out because we haven't directly appreciated you, is there a way to send us a message and for us to respond?
Well, I mean, we probably should have a way, shouldn't we?
We probably should have a way.
We're going to set that up and we will tell you for the next one.
Yeah, it'll be in the details. We'll like set up an email or something because we would love to hear from you. And what do you want to know? What do you want to hear about? What are you curious about? Alrighty. We'll see you in 2 weeks with our next episode. And Quincy, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, as always, we love doing this. We love you guys. And yeah, take care, everybody. And we will.